Marilyn Kring Productions in association with Emergent Life Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 9, delivered on September 17th.
Today, the Federal Reserve. This is the first of two topics, special topics, that are not covered in the book. You have resources online for this topic. The most important one is a video from the Federal Reserve that gives a sort of an overview of its operations. And you can follow that. I will be filling in quite a few details in this lecture. Take really good notes, because this is not the topic, kind of topic that's covered in finance textbooks very well anymore, even though it should be. And there are reasons, political reasons for that. Most finance people don't like to imagine that the Federal Reserve is so critical to the functioning of the markets, both here and abroad. But I'll get to that in a minute. First, the numbers. If we could actually have the... So what do you say? Is this a good day, sir? Or why are you dressed like that for my class? I mean, I appreciate it, but anyway, never mind. Good day or bad day? Or sort of mixed? Anything notable? It is mostly just a flat market. There's hardly anything happening. The market is extraordinarily quiet right now. It took a down drop yesterday. But right now, there's almost a quiet before the storm, a wait-and-see attitude about what is going to come, especially in the Middle East with the strikes on Saudi oil production facilities, taking down the world oil supply by about 5% for the time being. And then the usual saber-rattling by the important people here in the United States about how we have got to vindicate, stop this, and break the will of the perpetrators. Although I would not be too concerned about imminent war with Iran waged by the United States, simply because there is an actor on this world stage who has already sent back channel indications to our president, no, you will not do this. Now sit and bark. So there will be a lot of barking, but there's pretty much right now, there's no indication that a war with Iran is likely, unless something else happens in the next week or two, which actually might be the case. But for right now, we can all be calm and quiet. The markets are generally just slightly down, but if you look at the morning volume, the trading volume, there's a little bit of an up push, but I mean, it's volatile, quite volatile, there's no question about that. But that trading level, the volume for the morning against the average volume for the day, that is really low volume. You multiply that by two for a whole day, that's 698, 491, 345. I mean, that's take that times two, what is that, about 1.4 million against 1.4 billion, I'm sorry, against 3.5 billion on average for a whole day. Yeah, this is a real quiet day. Again, a wait-and-see kind of attitude. You can see the crude oil has actually slid in price again because the assessment of the damage to the world oil supply is not all that significant. 5%, they'll have it back up and running within a couple of months, and unless there are any more strikes by cruise missiles, not drones, cruise missiles, then there's probably not going to be any major spike in oil prices. However, it's a wait and see kind of day. So keep that in the back of your mind as you're making your plans to be drafted. Probably won't happen for a while. But to the topic of the day, let me erase someone's hard work and writing on my whiteboard. Yes. Start out with a couple of basics about central banks. In other words, the bank of a nation. The first of these actually came in the Renaissance period, in the 1600s. They didn't call them central banks, and they weren't built specifically to be central banks, but there's no question that there were these banks in Europe that were serving the sovereign. And they did mint money, and they took on all kinds of other tasks that would be described as central bank activities. By the 1700s, there was no question. These were central banks, Germany and other places. We had no use for that idea in the early years of this nation. There was absolutely no use whatsoever for the idea of a central bank. We don't want a big government. We don't want some central controller of the money supply, etc. It was so severe that this jackass president, by all accounts, everything from a murderer to an Indian slaughterer and an all-around asshole of a human being, Andrew Jackson, when there was a national bank in operation, the second attempt, he sent federal troops and they just raided the banks and took out all the money. And then he handed it out to the people. Populists, if ever there were one, at gunpoint, he just raided those banks because he wasn't going to have any of that central authority and all that. So we drift forward in time, trying banks essentially around the country would issue their own paper, currency as it were. And it was of widely varying quality. Some of it was not worth anything at all within days. The sod banks were a legendary source of screwing over people who deposited their money in them. There were some that were more reputable, and their paper they were like dollar bills. They were like, paper money. They were reasonably high quality, but there was no central money. I mean, you could go to the other side of the country with some of these dollars from one of these banks, and it was a hit or miss if anyone would take those drafts, as one might call them. And so we lurch forward. The United States government actually issued currency after the Civil War to pay off the debts that we had accumulated to various parties from which the U.S. the federal government had borrowed, and that was eventually withered away once the debt was paid off. Notice how I'm linking money, paper currency, with debt. That is an interesting feature. These paper monies are actually traditionally kind of like an obligation, like a note. Remember something from 1 to 7 years in duration or in maturity? This is the same tradition. These are pieces of debt paper. That's what they are. They're debt. They're little IOUs that the Federal Reserve prints, our central bank prints, on behalf of the United States government. Well, not on behalf of, it's a little technical there. I'm not going to get into a lot of the technical aspects of this. I would expect this to have been covered in your macroeconomics class. I've found out that I was wrong in that assumption. So I'll get into a little detail, but go back and take a good economics course if you want even more detail. Okay. Get into the 1870s, 1880s. You had all kinds of problems. Banks popping up, collapsing. Everywhere there was some nonsense going on. Let's take it back to the Middle Ages and see how this happens. In the Middle Ages, it was illegal for you, madam, to lend me money and interest in a commercial operation. You would like to borrow money from him. He runs a place where money can be stored. So you'd like to borrow some of that money. Well, he'd like to do that because he can make some money while he's keeping someone else's money in store. He could lend it to you, charge you some interest. Great. Well, that was illegal. If he did that, he would be put to death. It was called usury. U-S-U-R-Y. And variations on usury, anti-usury laws exist to this day. Not well enforced anymore, but there you are. In the Middle Ages, so in other words, it was deemed by the Holy Roman Catholic Church that charging interest on money was unlawful and immoral. Well, that is where the Jewish communities came in, because they had no such prescription and they weren't under the authority of the church. And so they would take people's money, put it in their safe houses, and then they would lend it out at money to finance whatever was financeable. Well, that pissed off a lot of Gentiles, and so they said, okay, it's illegal for everyone to do this. No one can do this. Solve that problem right off the bat. No one can charge interest. To this day, Islamic finance is based upon the principle that no interest can be charged. It gets a little bit complicated, but they've worked out a way that it kind of works. Don't ask me, that's a whole course. Anyway, so here's the problem. A prudent bank would do this. Okay, deposit. Let's say you put in $1,000 into a bank's reserve. We'll call that the initial deposit, D0. Now the bank will keep some of that in reserve in case the people who put it in want it back. Okay, that's fine. So we'll have a fractional reserve. And let's say that the fractional reserve ratio is 10%. So the bank is going to keep $100 in reserve. And then it has $900 that is lendable. No, not loanable, lendable. Okay, let's try this. You, madam, deposit $1,000 into my bank. I'm going to take that $1,000 and I'm going to peel off $100 and I'm going to put it here. In case you come in and you want some of it back, or you write a check for $20 or something like that, I've got the money to honor it, or to honor you if you want. Now you, sir, come to my bank and say, I need some money. I want to start a business. You do? Well, yes, I do. What kind of a business? Well, I want to be a male escort. Okay. Cougars are us. Yeah, it'll work. Good business model. Okay, so how much do you need? Well, I need $900. Well, spank me, I got that much money, $900. So I lend you $900. Now, you pay this guy to set up your website and, do the posters to go on the buses going by. Wow, cougars are us. Wow. Well, you, sir, did that work, and you come to my bank and you put in that $900. I got me some money in the bank now. Okay, great. I will abide by my reserve ratio of 10%, keep $90 of it, and that means that I'll have $810 to lend. You, sir, come to my bank and say, I should like to borrow some money to start a business. Oh, God, not another one like him. No, I want to make cookies. I want to be a cookie maker. Your sign says cookies and moi. Okay? Uh-huh. Well, how much do you need? $810. Well, that's all I've got. And so you pay this guy to set up your ovens, to set up, you know, some very nice, aprons for you to wear and all this kind of stuff. And so you pay him $810, which he then deposits in my bank. I got some money in the bank. And I look at that and I say, okay, I've got to keep 10% of that. That's $81, which leaves me $729. Is that right? 19. I'm going to bring up a calculator because this actually does get a little bit busier here. So I got 810 times 0.1 now plus 810. So the debit is 729. Okay, so 729. So now, you, madam, come to my bank and say, I should like to borrow some money. And what are you going to borrow money for? Well, I'm thinking of starting my own assassination squad, you know, sort of like the A team, except we'll call it the ISU team. You know, well, that sounds like a noble goal. Who are you going to assassinate? This professor who's always blabbing in class with weird examples and all that. Okay, fine. You know, profit before life, that's what I say. So you want to borrow $729, you pay the people to set it up, and they deposit that $729 in, of which $72.90 is kept in the bank, and that leaves minus 0.1 times $729. Well, that sucked really. Well, that certainly did take the wind out of my sails. 729 times 0.1 times 729. No, I'm doing this wrong. Minus the 71. 729 minus 0.1. I'm screwing it up every time. Screw that. Here's the point. Notice what's happening to the money supply. It's going upward. That bank has, by just the fourth round, 1,000 plus 900 plus 810 plus 729 in money on its books. The money is multiplying through this process of deposits and loans and reserves. You notice that this will actually converge on a number. There's a number that is called the money multiplier. The money multiplier. And that will be 1 over the fractional reserve ratio. Now, it's a little more complicated in real life because people sometimes keep money in their pockets instead of putting it in the bank. So this bleeds it a little bit, but it's pretty close. It's 1 over 0.10 in this case, which is 10. So in other words, if I take the original deposit times the money multiplier, that will be the total new money created. In this case, one $1,000 deposit created $1,000 times 1 over 0.10, which is $10,000. That's how much was created by a single $1,000 deposit. This is one of the ways we can grow the money supply. We can lower the fractional reserve ratio to make the money supply grow faster. Or we could raise the money the required reserve ratio and make the money supply grow more slowly.
We don't do that too often because it's kind of a blunt tool and we have better tools to do it. But that's one of them. Okay. The problem was that many banks were not keeping sufficient fractional reserves to satisfy the original depositors. Someone comes in and the bank doesn't have enough money in reserve, someone who put money in, the bank collapses right there and then. More worse, if one person can't be satisfied, then that's going to cause others with deposits there to freak out and run to the bank to try to get theirs out, and then it will be a total blowout. This was what happened in the late 1800s, into the early 1900s. You had these banks that didn't have enough reserves. Sometimes they didn't keep anything. And then people would come in to get their money out, and there wasn't any money there, and the bank would just, boom, fold right there. What was worse was that when people had one bank fold, they'd all freak out and run to their, if they saw someone else's bank folding, they'd freak out and run to their bank and try to get their money out. Now, that bank might very well keep a decent fractional reserve, but if everyone comes in there in a hysteria, it goes apart. Go. As a matter of fact, I don't even bring up black and white films anymore. I don't even try. But yeah, as a matter of fact, that was one of the subjects of a movie, Miracle on 34th Street. You could see a bank collapsing and other banks collapsing, if I recall, because one bank was bad and everyone ran the banks, and that's what it's called, run on the banks. Everyone ran. In fact, there were cases where some of these rich pigs in the big cities would start a rumor that a bank didn't have the reserves to satisfy its depositors. And if they could get enough people to run on that bank, it would collapse even though it was being prudent. It was keeping reserves. It just couldn't handle everybody at once. And so these nasty big fat cats would cause these banks to collapse, and then they'd walk in and take them over at pennies on the dollar. It was a very well-known trick. And there are some names that you might recognize, family names, that were involved in this kind of nonsense. To this day, conspiracy theorists love to bring up those family names. And part of it was because these guys really got bad reputations back in the day for the dirty stuff that they were doing. Okay, this was a problem. By the time we were getting into the late 1800s, early 1900s, these runs on banks weren't just a microeconomic problem. You know, a couple of neighborhoods, everyone loses all their money. This became a macroeconomic problem because you had regional ripples from bank failures. And when you start to cause, when you cause the poor and working class and the lower middle class suffering, who cares? But when the upper middle class and the rich start getting burned by bad things, suddenly, well, by God, we gotta get something done about this. And it's for the people who are doing this. Well, it was really because these bank failures were beginning to touch the rich, and they were beginning to cause political problems in some senators' and representatives' districts. So we began to talk about, how do you stop this? It's called a central bank, a bank that regulates every bank in the nation, a bank that has the backing of federal law and can make banks behave. Well, we don't believe in that kind of stuff. Government getting involved in commerce, well, that's just wrong. Well, it got to the point where it was just getting ridiculous. Now, enter the 1910s. You had a flow from a traditionally very conservative, right-wing kind of mentality in the country. And it began to flow toward the left to some extent. And you began to see reformers stepping into Congress
And we even had what probably could be described as the first modern liberal president, Woodrow Wilson. He tried to establish the sort of like a United Nations. It was called the League of Nations. Oh my God, you should have heard his screaming. It's a one world government, it's world government. But he kept pressing, and so did the reformers in Congress. And in 1913, they said, we've got to stop this bank nonsense. And so the Federal Reserve Act was passed. It established a central bank for the United States. Sort of the Johnny-come-lately of central banks among the nations of the developed world. We finally got around to it. And we did it right. There are some flaws that still to this day are embedded in it. But it was more or less a very solid act of Congress and has proven to be an enormous success. You have, of course, the conspiracy theorists and their end the Fed nonsense, but that's not going to happen. And you wouldn't want it to happen. Here's what the Fed did. The Federal Reserve, first of all, it created the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. This would be the top line of the Federal Reserve system, which was created by the Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve system would be overseen by this board of governors. There would be seven governors. These would be appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. Seven governors appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. Now, one of those would be the chairman. Watch it when I ask you this on a test or a quiz. There are seven governors plus one chairman. That's false. The chairman is one of the seven. And then there are six other governors. Of those six other governors, four are district bank presidents. The Federal Reserve System is actually divided the nation into 12 districts. Unfortunately, and this is one of the little flaws that's there to this day, the West Coast was not well populated back then. The East Coast was just this mass of people and commerce and banks. So the Federal Reserve districts were carved out so that you have little tiny districts on the East Coast. And as you go west, the district landmass gets bigger and bigger. Until you get out to San Francisco, it's just this enormous, enormous tract of land. Huge. Unfortunately, now the West Coast is very much as busy as the East Coast, so the San Francisco Bank and a couple other banks out there are just unbelievably pressured by how much they have to do these days. But that's the way it was. Now, the four district bank presidents, of these, one is a permanent member. And three serve rotating 2-year terms. Now, the one that is a permanent district bank is the New York Bank president. It's called the Empire Bank, and there's a very good reason that that one sits permanently on the board. Okay. Just follow that down. And then there are two others. Interestingly, and I don't quite get how this is happening, they're referring to the head of the Board of Governors now as the co-chairman, as if now they kind of have two people as the head of the Board of Governors. I'm not sure about that. How that works. But anyway, the chairman is a powerful person. Most recently, before the current era, we had a woman, Janet Yellen. Before her, we had a weakling named Ben Bernanke. Before that, we had Alan Greenspan, who started out magnificently and ended up a demented old weirdo. And before that, we had the great Paul Volcker, the beast of the Fed, who brought us back from the brink of catastrophe. But anyway, that is the layout. Okay, so the Federal Reserve System, these Board of Governors and all this, they have three jobs. One is that they regulate and supervise the banking system. They regulate and supervise. When laws are passed by the Congress and signed by the President, the Board of Governors sets forth the regulations that interpret those laws. That's what regulations do. Regulations are how we articulate laws into practice. And then the supervision, once the regulations are created, supervision is the responsibility of the district bank presidents. So the Board of Governors regulates and the district banks supervise. They go out and audit the banks. Remember that. I will ask that on a test or a quiz. I promise you. Who regulates, who supervises, something along that line. This is a little more complicated now than it used to be. The Federal Reserve is not regulating and supervising all banks. It's a frickin' turf war. There are some banks that are regulated by the Fed, that's the big dog. Then there are other banks that are regulated by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Then there are other banks that are regulated by the Comptroller of the Currency. If that's not enough, there are banks that are state chartered that are regulated by the states. And credit unions are regulated by another agency. After the fiasco of 2008, when the whole world almost went to financial apocalypse, Congress said, all right, we got to have a single regulator of all banks in this country. We've got to stop this. And everyone, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, until you got down to the brass tacks and turf war, FDIC, we ain't giving up our banks. The state said, you can't interfere with state, that's dual sovereignty. You can't do that. Oh, everyone suddenly got real defensive. So we are in the same mess we were back then. There is no full central regulator of all banks in the country. Even worse than that, there are banks in other countries that are using our currency that the Federal Reserve claims control over, but they just game those sons of bitches when they come down there to audit. When I was down in Panama, they use American currency. That is their currency of denomination. And so I said, well, the Federal Reserve doesn't really have any control on what's going on in these banks. And then, of course, there were a couple of young people who worked in those banks or their parents were big dogs in those banks and said, oh, the Fed's down here all the time auditing us. And I said, yeah, you keep two sets of books. I know how it works. Did you show them the money that's coming in from Russia? No, you laundered that through some shell companies in the Dutch Antilles and the Bahamas. No, not the Bahamas. There's another one. Never mind. Okay. We've got a mess, and it is even worse now than it was back then. But anyway, it's a good idea in theory.
And if you want a job as one of the supervising teams that goes to the banks for one of the different agencies, let me know. They're always looking for new people. Finance and accounting, yes, but they like other people too. As long as you're not afraid of numbers, you go in teams, you audit banks, and then you go home, drive home for the evening, you get free meals on the road, and you're usually home every night. So it's not a bad life. And you get to kick some white collar butt. Two, the Federal Reserve Act gave the Fed, as we call it, gave the Fed the authority to be a bank for banks. A bank has to put its money somewhere. A bank has to have a checking account. So, and it can't do it for itself. So if you run a bank, ma'am, you need someplace to deposit your bank money and write checks. So you could come to me. I could be a commercial bank. Or there are credit unions have the equivalent of it. They're called federal credit unions. Now, the Federal Reserve had this rule set forth right away. You can do this. You can be a bank for banks, but you may not outcompete the private commercial banks that do it. There are a lot of commercial banks, privately owned or publicly, you know, something like that, that will provide services for banks. And the Federal Reserve does it too. The rule is the Federal Reserve cannot do anything that would damage the profitability of those banks. Just by existing, though, it causes the bank fees for banks to be lower. And the Federal Reserve must spend lots and lots of money on new technologies. And when it comes up with a new banking technology, it has to share it for free with its private competitors. In other words, you know, you've seen regular checks, that little magnetic strip down there, those weird-looking numbers and letters. That was a Federal Reserve innovation many, many, many years ago. And then they shared it with all of their competitors. This is amazing because commercial banks that do banking for banks, they're doing fine. The Federal Reserve is making so much money every year, it turns over to the Treasury its profit, which is in the billions of dollars every year doing this. And all of those cool things, like you put your debit card in and a few seconds later you can pull it out and you've paid for it, that was Fed. And then they shared it with all the banks, the electronics of that technology. Everything you see pretty much was an innovation of the Fed that they shared. So the idea that you cannot have a successful competitive structure that involves both a government agency and private industry is ridiculous. I tried to bring this up back when it's been about 10 years ago. There was talk of health care reform. We need health insurance that is affordable for everyone in the United States. And of course, you had the free marketers saying, it's fine the way it is. Private insurers, that's how it is. Get a job and you can have some insurance. And then you had the leftist socialists. One single pay provider. That's the government. Let's have the government be a giant socialist institution for this. And I was writing these sad little articles. People, we've got a system. It's worked for a century, for God's sake. You can have both at the same time. A government agency that provides healthcare insurance, does technological innovation for the delivery of the care insurance and all that. It has to be shared with the private competitors. It is by law not allowed to break their backs by predatory pricing. It works. And of course, no one listened to me. I just got stomped under the dust storm that was then. And so they passed the Health Care Act, which is essentially a really ugly version of that thing but anyway. Okay, bank for banks. And then the big one. The Fed conducts monetary policy.
In other words,
it controls the money supply. It really wasn't supposed to do this to begin with. That was forbidden at first, but sometime in the 1970s, they snuck it into the Federal Reserve's job. Originally, the purpose of conducting monetary policy was to get it out of the hands of the politicians. See, the politicians would just print money hand over fist to make themselves popular. They just print money. But printing money is the reason we have inflation. Now, understand this. There's one and only one actual cause of true inflation. One. No, it's not dirty unions jacking up their wages. No, it's not filthy, greedy corporations jacking up their prices. Those are not inflation. They can't create inflation. The only thing that can create inflation is when the growth of the money supply is larger, faster than the growth of the economy. In other words, if the economy is growing at 3% and you grow the money supply at 3%, prices stay level. But if the economy is growing at 3% and you grow the money supply at 4%, you will eventually create inflation. Similarly, if the economy is growing at, let's say, 2%, but the money supply is not growing at all, you will eventually either cause a deflation or an economic collapse. That last one, that latter one, was what happened in the years leading up to 2008. You will see it. I will show you the original graphics before they got played with by some monkeys at the Fed. We stopped allowing the base money supply, M1, to grow. The economy was still growing. After about 4 years, 5 years of this, the economy just buckled because there wasn't enough liquidity in the economy. That was the underlying cause of the whole fiasco. And you will see it in a graph. You'll also see something else that's even much more mind-blowing. But anyway, the Fed has to do monetary policy. It has three tools for this. The first one I already showed you. The first tool of monetary policy is that required reserve ratio. It sets it. See if it sets it. If it sets the required reserve ratio, let's say at 0.05, the money supply would grow at 20 times. If it sets it higher, let's say at 0.2, the money multiplier would be only 5 times. So it sets it to sort of like a regulatory valve on how fast money can grow through the banking system. Someone asked me, it's been some years back when I was teaching economics at another university, well, what is it? What do you mean, what is what? And I said, well, he said, what's the required reserve ratio right now? And I sat there like an idiot. I didn't know. Well, I said, well, I suppose it's maybe about, I don't know, about 10%. So I got off my duff that afternoon and I called the Fed in St. Louis, where I had a couple of my fellow students from Ohio State who are now, they were bigwigs there by that time, and I was still teaching in schools. Anyway, I got a hold of what I said, okay, what is the required reserve ratio right now for banks? And he said, which one? I said, wait, what? He said, yeah, we have several. I didn't know that. Yeah, and he explained to me, okay, it has to do with the tranches, T-R-A-N-C-H-E-S. He said the first tranche of money, $0 to $10 million, it has its own required reserve ratio. Then from $10 million, $1 up to something like $50 million, there's another required reserve ratio. And then above $50 million, there's another required reserve ratio.
which so it's a little more complicated than I had known. You know, I had advanced degrees in economics, and I didn't know this. And I said, okay, what's the first tranche required reserve ratio? And he said, zero. I said, well, wait. You mean the first $10 million of money, the bank is not required to keep any of that in reserve? He said, that's right. This allows small banks, like community banks, things like that, to get that money back out into the community that's deposited there in loans for houses, loans for small businesses. And I thought, well, I said, so in other words, the money multiplier on that one is 1 over 0, which is infinity. He said, well, technically it is, but it isn't. And of course, I knew that the real money multiplier has a few other factors in the denominator. But still, and then the second tranche has a higher one, and then the third tranche has a much higher one. Now, this is a blunt force meat axe. It is not something the Fed moves around willy-nilly. It tries to keep it fairly level. If there is a little bit of lack of confidence in the banking system, the Fed might push it up a little bit. So banks have to keep more reserves. If everything is good and healthy, then the Fed might push it down some. So for example, when the attacks on 9/11 happened, you would see the Fed raise the fractional reserve ratio because they thought people are going to freak, they're going to run to their banks because America is under attack right on the homeland. And then of course, when that didn't happen, they would lower it again after everyone was calmed down from the attacks. I'm saying that because that plays into my last story here in a little while. Okay, anyway, not used very often. Yeah, it can make the money supply grow. It can make the money supply grow fast or slow, but it's not used very much at all. The second one is big. You see, the Fed lends money to banks. The Federal Reserve lends money to banks. It's a bank for banks. It'll make a loan to a bank. It has an interest rate that it charges. It's called the discount rate. A bank can go to the discount window and ask for a loan. But a bank could do another thing, too. Here's a bank. It needs money. It could go to the Fed discount window and pay the discount rate, but it could also go to the federal funds market. The federal funds market is just this giant pool of all of the money banks have. It's a vast ocean underlying the economy. Now, if the Fed, you don't know which one do you go to. Now, the Fed discount window, you would pay the discount rate that the Fed sets. Over here, if you go to the federal funds market, you would pay the Fed funds rate. The discount rate is going to be less than the Fed funds rate. If you borrow from the Fed, it's at a lower price. It's at a lower cost. If you borrow from the Fed funds market, you'll pay a higher price for borrowing money. Well, why would any bank ever go to the federal funds market? Think about it this way. You, sir, I am your father. I know it's a dream come true. I finally had to tell you. This is your bro buddy, okay? Now, you need $1,000, like real fast. I mean, you will not be alive tomorrow if you don't have that money. It's one of those situations that just kind of happened, and you need $1,000. Okay, you know I'm good for the money. I'm your father. You know he's good for the money. He's your friend. You know I will charge you a very low rate. You know he'll charge you more. Why wouldn't you come to me for the money? Come on. Why wouldn't you come to me for the money? Oh, you can get it fast, immediate, instantly, electronically. It'll be in your account. Think about it. You need $1,000 and you need it like ASAP. Yeah. Okay. Don't you think I'm going to ask you some really pointed questions about why you need it? What the hell do you need that kind of money for? OMG. Was it those guys you were hanging out with and you said they had a commercial operation you could join that involved gas masks? And you kept watching that weird show. What was it, Breaking Stupid or Breaking Bad? What? He's not going to ask any questions. Sure, bro. Here. You see, I am your daddy. I am going to give. Oh, how many times I've said that. God, it's hot in this room. Okay, now. You understand? Shut up. Okay. Yeah. You might very well go to the Fed Funds market because it is not the government. You're not asking for it from someone who might ask you questions, who might put in impose rules on the pay on it. You see, traditionally, that discount rate wasn't really all that effective because it wasn't used that much. It was a signal. If the Fed raises the discount rate, that means the Fed wants the economy to slow down. If the Fed drops the discount rate, it wants the economy to speed up. It was more like a message. The Federal Reserve, right now, the Federal Reserve has lowered the discount rate again. It is signaling that the economy is in trouble. Even though everyone is saying in the government, well, there's no problem. Everyone knows that we are on the brink of a horrific recession. And so the Fed is dropping the discount rate down as far as it can. In fact, our president wants the Fed to make interest rates negative. So that means if you borrow money from a bank, the bank pays you interest. Works for me. But I can guarantee you that's not going to work for the economy. We have been lowering the discount rate to the point where there's no question we'll have a recession, but we will have inflation as well. The Federal Reserve cannot set the federal funds rate. It can put a target on it to try to make it go where it wants. But you will hear endlessly these financial news networks, well, the Fed set the federal funds rate today at, no, it didn't. The federal funds rate is purely the result of supply and demand dynamics of the money in that the federal funds money, that vast pool of money. How much of it is wanted? How much of it is available? And so the Fed funds rate just moves on its own up and down based upon supply and demand of the funds. The Fed can set a target, and it can try to make it happen, but it cannot set it. In other words, the Fed funds rate is simply set if there is money, and here is the price of money, the Fed funds rate. There is a demand for money, and there is a supply of money. Just plain old basic economics. That will set the federal funds rate. That's what it'll be. Now, the Fed can try to move the supply and demand curves through the third thing. but it has only limited control over it. Usually the Fed funds rate will kind of follow what the Fed wants it to do. But when you get to worry is when the Fed keeps saying, you will do that, and the federal funds rate says no, which is what's happening now. Essentially, interest rates want to go up. They want to. They have to. And so when the Fed tries to force that federal funds rate down through this third tool called open market operations, OMOs, it's not working too well now. There's only so much you can do to force a vast ocean of money to obey your whims. Supply and demand dynamics will come through. And this is true in any market. You can pass laws, you can even bring in law enforcement to force markets to have prices you want, but they will always find a way around it. Free markets find a way. And that's what's happening right now. But these open market operations, now the discount rate, 8 times a year, if there's an emergency, maybe a little more. So they're more frequent, but like I said, banks usually went to the Fed funds market. Anymore, now that the discount rate is such a low thing, you know, the banks line up for the money nowadays, but historically it was not changed that often, and it was not even actually a practical thing. These, however, open market operations, they happen every day of every week of every year. Billions of dollars flowing around that almost no one understands, has no idea that this force of nature is happening between the banks and the Federal Reserve. Now, I don't anticipate that you will know it enough. It should have been done in macroeconomics, and they don't do it now. But here's the basic. Just know the basic outline. Here's a bank, and here's the Fed. Now, a bank has different tiers of capital. In the tier one, the bank will have actual physical dollars, and it will have T-bills. They are both of equal quality as far as liquidity goes. The only difference is that a bank can lend money. A bank cannot lend its T-bills. But both of these will count toward a bank's tier one high quality capital, part of its reserve ratio. Now, the Fed, when the Fed wants to change the money supply to grow the economy or to contract it, it communicates this, the decision-making body at the Fed. It's called the Federal Open Market Committee. The FOMC. It has all 7 governors. It has 1 permanent district bank president. And then it has 4 rotating bank presidents. Is that right?
And that's the same 7 governors.
Oh yeah. They're all very important people. Now the one that is a permanent member is the New York bank president. The others three serve two-year terms. And that, why am I thinking 8 and 4? No, I'm sorry. That's the problem. 3 here, I'm sorry. Because that makes the 12. They'll show you this in the video too. The reason the Empire Bank president is permanently on there is because the Federal Open Market Committee decides we're going to expand the money supply. We're going to contract the money supply. That is carried out by the New York Bank. Seven, eight, 9, 10, 11. Why am I thinking? I keep writing, wanting to write 3. Well, yeah, the chairman is one of the 7. My mind isn't working here. It's 5 and 7. It is 4. Okay. Now, the open market desk. Otherwise known as the domestic trading desk, is at the New York Fed. It's not a single desk, it's a bunch, yeah.
So is this only 4 over there then, or what? So 1 permanent, 4 rotating?
Yeah, this is just all the different positions that are available. In other words, in the Federal Reserve system, there are 7 governors. And then this applies to that over there, but there are actually 12 total districts. Yeah, that was where I was getting myself confused. I apologize for that. Oh, yeah, it's sort of like a sub-branch. You see, what they'll do is they'll pull in the for a meeting, they pull in the 7 governors, and then they pull in that 1 New York bank president. And they pull in from the 12, 4 more, or from the 11, 4 more. Yeah, no, not on the Board of Governors, on the FOMC. On the FOMC, there are, let me do that again, because I wrote something about the FOMC before I was ready to talk about it. Let me do this. This is the Fed, 7 governors and 12 district bank presidents. You're right, I'm talking while I was writing. Now, let's do this. Now, the FOMC, which is part of the Fed, pulls the 7 governors, and then it pulls a total of 5 bank presidents. Just completely cross out that over there. God, okay. Now, this is 1 plus 4. 1 is in New York, and then 4 rotating of the bank presidents. Yeah, burn this one over here. I wrote that before I was ready to talk about the FOMC. Okay, now, the New York has the domestic trading desk, as it's usually called. So when the FOMC makes a decision, the New York bank president calls his bank or runs back there and says, we are going to do this. And the way they do that is the domestic desk, which is in New York City, its traders also have dollars and T-bills. And what they'll do is if they want to drain liquidity, They will sell T-bills to the banks, and the banks will give them money. They will sell T-bills to the banks, and the banks will give the Fed money. And that makes money disappear from the federal funds market. On the other hand, if the Fed wants to add money to the economy, what it will do is its traders will go to the banks and say, we want to buy some of your T-bills. So what in that case, they will send T-bills to the Fed, and the Fed will send them money to add money to the economy. Now let me show you the upshot. As I had told you before, there are three different levels of money, liquidity-wise. If you look here, first of all, do you see what I meant by what happened to the Fed? The Fed was trying to slow down M1. Because it couldn't control the euro dollars, which were exploding before 2008. The way it tried to do it was to clamp down the money that households and businesses use. That was the proximate cause that no one wants to talk about of the crash. Now, a lot of people, it's funny, people say, what was this spike here? Oh, my God. And then that downspike. Oh, that was when 9/11 happened. The Fed drove literally giant caravans of monies to the banks around the country so that if people did freak, the banks would have all the money they needed to get these people happy again. And so when people didn't freak, they drained it back out. That's what this spike is. See it there? That was all those Fed trucks literally driving cash money to banks all over the country, one of the biggest operations financial in the world, except there's a problem.
So then did that drove the federal funds rate up?
Down, because supply of money. But there's a problem here. Now calm down, put your books down for a second and look. This was the spike when the trucks delivered the money to the banks. Right, 9/11? Why was the money supply doing that for over a month before 9/11 happened? Do you see it? That's 9/11 right there.
2002?
No, 2001. This is 2000, 2001. Look at the money supply. Look at the money. Look at it. Were those trucks on the road on 9/11? Yeah. There is no bubble of .com. That was over. This was a prediction that there was going to be an attack. 9/11 was here, and yet the Fed was pouring money into the banks back here. Now, what does that mean? That's all I have for you.